would be water, because all the people being bad and crying about this and crying about thirst, and Moses was mad at him and struck the rock twice and the water came out, and God come down with a vengeance on the people himself, only against God's word.
Yeah, so Moses, because of that, Moses wasn't going to be allowed to go into the...
And he was banned from going into Canaan.
What, by refusing to believe God, what did the Israelites show what they thought of God? In other words, they didn't believe him when he said...
discontent, I guess.
Discontent. If you don't believe somebody, what do you think, what are you basically telling that person?
That they're lying?
Ah, yeah, they're a liar. In that sense, I mean, I guess you could play on that. That, you know, I don't believe somebody, but if, you know, the presidential debate was the other night, and you heard both, if you watched that, some of it, it was both sides of it were going back and forth, and Trump said he didn't believe Hillary, and Hillary says she didn't believe Trump. What are they both saying about each other? They're both lying, right? They're both saying that they both are lying about these things. Mm-hmm. And that's, in essence, what we do when we don't believe God. We basically say that he's a liar. We also talk about the bronze snake on the pole. What stands out to your memory about that? You smiled, so I'm going to point at you, John. Right, anyone who looked at the bronze snake was healed. And if we get that from the authors, their medical world today uses some places still use this snake on a pole as a reminder. And what did that say that about that? When they looked at the pole, they were basically saying what?
They're believing what God did.
Right, they're believing that God said he was going to do, and that they believed it, and they were healed, right?
But at the same time, John brought up the question about, snake as a worship thing.
Yeah, John's question was, how come God told him to make a told Moses to make a bronze snake and put it on a pole when he told his people that do not make graven images of anything like this on the earth beneath? Why would God do that? It almost sounds like God's contradiction. But God wasn't telling them to worship the snake.
Right.
He just said, look at it. And we do that all the time. We make things today, images, we make pictures of our kids, we put them up on the walls, we make pictures of our families and things like that. That we're not worshiping them, but they're up there as a reminder. So, yeah. So tonight's lesson, though, is where God takes the Israelites into Canaan, and then God chooses their leaders and their king. We are going to go through the Bible here really, really quickly. And matter of fact, we're going to be getting into the New Testament here in the next couple of weeks. That's how fast we're going to skip over all these other stories in the Bible. So if you got your Bibles, flip to Numbers 27. That's where we're going to pick up, Numbers 27, 18 through 23. And while you're going there, remember that Moses was not allowed to go into lead the new generation. Remember, everybody from 20 years old and older was going to die. And we talked about that. What would it be like to have been a 20-year-old young man or woman knowing that you were going to wander in the wilderness for 1 year for every day they were in the... Remember, the spies were in the wilderness. They were spying out for 40 days. And God said, you're going to wander in the wilderness 1 year for every day that your spies were. So it'd be 40 years. And yet, everybody that was 20 years old and older was going to die. So if you were 20 years old and you got to your 60th birthday and you knew that you were going to die, what would that make your life like? What would you think? I mean, what would you do? It would change the way you live. What would you do knowing that I've only got 40 years left at max? I might die somewhere in between there, but I got a max of 40 years. Totally blew my mind when I had to think about that. But
right,
and God had told me
up to that last year, and
yeah,
last 6 months.
What haven't I done that I need to do?
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's just, it would make you change the way you live. And so Numbers 27, 18 through 23. And let's see what this says. Who wants to read it?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Oops. I just lost it. Hold on.
That's what you get for playing with my phone.
And Jehovah said unto Moses, take thee Joshua the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay thy hand upon him, and set him before Eleazar the priest, before all the congregation, and give him a charge in their sight. And thou shalt put of thine honor upon him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may obey. And he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before Jehovah. At his word shall they go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and all the children of Israel with them, even all the congregation. And Moses did as Jehovah commanded, and he took Joshua and sent him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation. And he laid his hands upon him and gave him a charge as Jehovah spoke to Moses, spoke by Moses.
So here we got Moses laying out the groundwork for the changing of the guard, or changing of the leadership position, and he sets it up, and he brings Joshua before the whole group and the high priest, and he anoints him. And so that's where we come to on the timeline now, the transition from Moses to Joshua, the leadership. And notice that we have a little bit of a time frame here before where Moses dies. We're going to read about Moses' death. And why do you think that was a time in between Moses and Joshua? Joshua was going to be put in charge, but Moses is there. Why would you think God would do that? Why wouldn't he wait till Moses dies and then appoint Joshua?
So Moses can teach him.
Yeah, so there would be some sense of some learning that would go along with Moses there in the wilderness. I mean, why he's there, he's getting ready to transition. Plus, it also gives validation that Moses, who the people looked up to, who followed, was saying, okay, here's the person that God has put in place. Follow him now. And he was able to transition that time with them. And so it wasn't just like a quick transition. It was a time frame. So flip over to Deuteronomy 34, 1 through 5. And we're going to read now where it comes time for Moses to die. And in studying this or reading this, I thought this was very interesting. And it says, then Moses went up to Mount Nebo from the plains of Moab and climbed to the top of Pisgah's peak, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him the entire land from Gilead as far as Dan, all the land of Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah, extending to the Mediterranean Sea, the Negev, or the Jordan Valley with Jericho, the city of the palms, as far as Zur. Then the Lord said to Moses, this is the land I promised on the oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Then when I said, I will give it to your descendants, I have now allowed you to see it with your own eyes, but you will not enter the land. Remember, it goes back to his striking the rock twice instead of speaking to it. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, just as the Lord had said. And verse 6 is not mentioned here, but I want to read it. The Lord buried him in the valley near Bethpor of Moab. To this day, no one knows the exact place. So you got to get this picture. The relationship between God and Moses was such that God said, go up to the top of this mountain, I want to show you. He goes to the top of the mountain and he dies. God just didn't leave his body there laying on the ground for the... God actually took him and went and buried him himself. So no man knows where he's buried at. And I found that very interesting to have that kind of relationship with God, that God would be willing to say, okay, I'm going to bury you. I kind of was wondering, what the kind of funeral service was that? You know, the Bible doesn't say, but did God sit back and have his angels sing? And I don't know. But I had to let my mind roll. But I thought about that, and I'm like, you know, this is a thing. And so, when God says it's time to go, it's time to go.
So, was he the only person that, according to the Bible, that God did that for?
To my knowledge, yes. I'd have to look it up and study that. But to my knowledge, he's the only one. And to my knowledge, he's the there were others who God took. Enoch, we learned about, God took him.
Mm-hmm.
So he never died. How that happened, how that worked, I don't know. We know that, I think it's either Elijah or Elisha was carried off on a chariot.
Right.
Fiery chariot. So we know that there are men who do not die, and that also had a relationship with God, and God took them.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some pretty cool thing there with that, but I just thought I'd point that wasn't part of the lesson thing. Let's read verse 9 of chapter 34. And it goes like this. Now Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the people of Israel obeyed him, doing just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Again, no really change there. And it goes on to Joshua 1 verse 2. And it says, and after the death of Moses, the Lord's servant, the Lord spoke to Joshua of Nun, Moses' assistant, and said, Moses, my servant is dead. Therefore, his time has come for you to lead these people, the Israelites, across the Jordan River into the land I am giving them. I promise you that what I promised Moses, wherever you set your foot, you will be on land I have given you. So God laid it out, and he says, this is what it is. So it's time to go now. Go pack it up. Moses is dead. I've laid in the rest. Go get the rest of the people. Let's go. So now he's getting all these people, and he's getting ready to cross into the land of Canaan. How had Satan in this, prior to this, before we continue on, how would have Satan tried to prohibit this from taking place?
How would he try to prohibit it?
Mm-hmm. In the past. Like in Moses' life, how did he try to prohibit all this from taking place? And as we wrap up Moses' life.
I would say the will of the people, I mean, constantly complaining about this, that, the other,
Moses'
heart being hardened.
We had the story, well, we didn't quite cover it, but we had the story where they rebelled and God opened the earth up and swept them in.
Right.
We had them worshiping the idol. We had him even in Egypt. We had all the situations where the quail and the manna God was providing, they began to crumble and complain, become discontent with God to provide them.
Right.
So he had all these different aspects where Satan tried to intervene and try to hinder them, and now they're getting ready to cross the promised land. What do you think is going to happen? Think Satan's just going to sit by and let them go?
Oh, no.
He's still got some tricks.
Yeah, exactly. Let's flip over to Joshua 11, verse 23. And this is, we're only going to read two passages in Joshua here. Someone want to grab Joshua 23, 14 through 16. We'll get ready to read that one a little bit. All right, so if we know that Satan can't hinder it, then why should Satan even keep trying? But that's not what happens. Here it is in Joshua 11:23. This is what happens to the children of Israel. Turn one page too many. Here we go. So you see, it was the Lord, the God of Israel, who took away the land from the Amorites and gave it to Israel. Why then should we give it back to you? Who's asking that question? We haven't really talked about that here because we skipped over a bunch of verses. But when you think about that, when it says, why should we give it back to you? Who's really, you think, talking there? Is that Satan?
Yeah, it could be, possibly.
Could be, right? But or could be Satan speaking through someone else. If you go back up to verse 20, it's a king. And he didn't trust Israel to pass through his land. Instead, he got his army together and attacked them. The Lord said to Israel, it gave his people victory over the king. And then when they got to, then they began to cross the Anon River to Jabbok River and from the east westward to the Jordan River. So they're getting ready to head on. And they begin to ask that. And you keep whatever your God, Chemosh, gives you, and we'll keep whatever the Lord our God gives us. That was their response. So these are the children of Israel here. and all these years, over and over again, they tried to prevent. Even as soon as they crossed into the land, as they began to cross into it, they faced opposition right off of that.
Right. Here's so were they fighting? I mean, every time they went, were they fighting with
the... Well, they weren't planning to fight at first. They went into the land, and this king, instead of letting them pass freely, began to resist them.
Right.
And so they did fight him, and God gave them a victory over him. But again, we see this pattern of Satan trying to use people, trying to do things to prohibit the children of Israel from entering the Canaan land, because it's one more step in God's plan to bring about the deliverer. And God says he's faithful, so God went on and did what he think, went on and continued to do what he said he was going to do. Did someone grab Joshua 23:14-16?
And behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth, and ye know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one thing has failed of all the good things which Jehovah your God spake concerning you. All shall come to pass unto you, not one thing has failed thereof. And it shall come to pass that as all the good things have come upon you, of which Jehovah your God spake to you, so will Jehovah bring upon you all the evil things, until he hath destroyed you from off this good land which Jehovah your God has given you. When ye transgress the covenant of the Jehovah your God, which he has commanded you, and go and serve other gods, and bow down yourselves to them, then will the anger of Jehovah be kindled against you, and ye shall perish quickly from off the good land which he hath given unto you.
So this is Joshua's final word to the people, the children of Israel. If you read through the entire book of Joshua, you'll begin to see all the things that God did for the children of Israel as they went in and captured. You have the story of Jericho. You have, after the story of Jericho, you have a situation where someone in the camp disobeys God, and many, many Israelite men, warriors, died because they disobeyed God and they found out. Anybody know that story? He stole some silver and gold and clothing and hid them under his tent. They were supposed to give all the spoils to the tabernacle, to the work, or to the service of the Lord. And he kind of hid them for himself, kind of kept it. And his whole family, they ended up stoning his whole family because of that. And here's Joshua. He's kind of reminding all the children of Israel of all the things that God has done, and he finishes it out. He's getting old. He's getting ready to die himself. And we flip over to Judges chapter 2, verses 7 through 13. And it says this: And the Israelites served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and the leaders who outlived him, those who had seen all the great things the Lord had done before Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. They buried him in the land that he had allocated at Timzerah, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. I'm not pronouncing these right, but so what? After that generation died, another generation grew up who did not acknowledge the Lord or remember the mighty things that he had done for Israel. The Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight and served the images of Baal. They abandoned the Lord and the God of their ancestors who brought them out of Egypt. They went after other gods, worshiping gods of the people around them. And they angered the Lord. They abandoned the Lord to serve Baal and images of Ashtaroth. What happened?
As soon as Joshua passed, I take it, is what it was saying, they forgot.
Yeah, well, who? Why would they forget? I mean...
Nobody was teaching?
Nobody was teaching. So who was doing the deception? Satan, right, exactly. Satan was at it. And so who were they worshiping then? When it says they were worshiping Baal and these...
Baal, that's an evil...
Well, I'm looking for what I'm. So I got this. Put this in my house and set it up. It's just a statue, right? Pretend this is a statue, I guess. It's a statue of an idol or something. And so I bow down and I pray to it and I worship to it. Am I really worshiping this? Or who am I worshiping?
A false idol. Deceiver.
Yes, yes. Who are we worshiping? When we worship idols, When we worship things in our life that we put higher than God, who are we ultimately worshiping?
Satan.
Satan, his demons, his forces. We are worshiping them, and that's what these people were doing. They weren't worshiping, they were bowing themselves down to these idols. But they were not only doing that, but they were worshiping Satan.
Yeah, because Satan was put on the earth to rule, the earth, and all the things that were
God gave him dominion over.
To deceive. Yeah, that's the number one goal.
And so there's only two kingdoms, remember? We have the heavenly kingdom and we have the earthly kingdom, and there's only two.
Right.
And whichever one you serve, you're worshiping.
Right.
Well, so this does this beg difference then? How come they didn't realize they were worshiping Satan? Why wasn't this generation aware that they were worshiping Satan?
Maybe God wasn't so prevalent like he was earlier. I mean, you know, the pillar of cloud and smoke and you know what I mean? And it seems like it's like a downturn now.
Okay, yeah. If you go back to what it said right after Joshua died, it said, and then his generation died. The generation that he was a part of died.
Right.
And another generation then grew up. So the next generation didn't grow up understanding the God that we serve. They didn't understand that. They didn't understand that, and so they went after.
But they lived in the here and now.
Right.
So did they know? They knew about Satan, or didn't they?
Well, that's what I'm wondering.
Because it doesn't look like so far, you know, Satan that they haven't talked about him at all.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so Satan's not in this thing. So what would make man just go and start worshiping an idol? Well, let's step back. What's some of the characteristics of Satan?
Greed.
Deception. Yes, he's a deceiver. Right. And what else is he in? If he's a deceiver and he's one of his characters is deception, what's that make him? What's that make him a master of?
Lying.
Huh?
Lying.
Yeah. Make it this
manipulation.
Making something look beautiful that's not. Make something look good that it, you know. He said that Eve in the garden. The characteristic he said, well, you'll be like God. That's why he doesn't want you to eat this fruit.
Yeah. The words in my mouth. It starts right back from the beginning again when they thought they could be like God.
Yeah.
So they had that, I guess, knowledge, but they would have the knowledge of good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew they should have known better. But.
And it says they did evil in the Lord's sight. So in other words, God's watching. He's looking, he's seeing, and they begin to do evil. And what would be the purpose of Satan wanting all this generation to not worship God?
To make him stronger?
To make him feel like he was a winner.
Make him feel like what?
He was stronger.
Make him feel like he was stronger? Yeah. Trying to think of how we would understand, how I would want to say this without giving you the answer. I don't want to give you the answer. It's not fair if I give you the answer. What do the politicians do that are on the political scheme right now? What do they do to get followers?
Well, they'll say
false promises.
Yes. They do whatever they can, right? They'll tell you whatever you can to get your vote.
Right.
As soon as they get your vote, they don't care about that.
See you 4 years from now.
Correct. And then they say the same thing again, and people get sucked right into it.
Yes.
Satan's the same way. His whole purpose was to lead children of Israel away from God. And he was going to do whatever means possible. Deception, deceiving them, he'll lie to them, he'll make the evil that they're committing look like it's good and it's alright because everybody's doing it. Notice that the images of Baal and the Ashtaroth, God, images of Ashtaroth that they were worshiping, those were not images that were created by the Israelites. Those were worshipped by the people that were surrounding him, countries that were surrounding him. That's who they worshipped. So it was very easy. Well, they're doing it, so it must be right. I'll just join right in, and I'm doing it. Now, I'm good, too. And we see that today. Well, this person over here calls himself a Christian, and they're doing this, so I can do that, too, without seeking what God says, the character of God. And it's very simple to follow. Very easy to do. I've done it. Well, that's, yeah. And then you feel convicted about something and look it up and see, and, well, oh, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Now, and so, and Satan was doing that. And he was, they were guiding, Satan was guiding it, teaching it. What do you think God does? You think God just stands by and just lets him keep worshiping?
No.
Now, the character of God, in all throughout so far, we know that God didn't, God just let the Israelites do whatever they want, right? He never punished them whatsoever, never disciplined them, never chastise or nothing, right?
Oh, no.
No, he didn't, right? He brought
you. He come down.
We just
put some rest.
Exactly. We just had the 20 years, right? And just really, and this generation didn't remember that. So let's flip over to verses 14 through 15. Let's see what it says. And it says this: "This made the Lord burn with anger against Israel. So he handed them over to raiders who stole their possessions. He turned them over to their enemies all around. They were no longer able to resist him. Every time Israel went out to fight, the Lord fought against them, causing them to be defeated, just as he had warned. And the people were in great distress. Remember the warning that Joshua gave to them. If you break the covenant of the Lord by worshiping them, worshiping and serving other gods, his anger will burn against you, and you will quickly vanish from the good land he has given you." That was the warning that Joshua gave to the children of Israel. If you don't follow God, his anger is going to burn against you. And so here we are, we have this thing. What does that tell us about the character of God?
Yeah, he means what he says.
He means what he says. It doesn't change. He didn't compromise. They're just a new generation. They've never heard about me.
Right.
No, he said
so
no.
Is this the second generation now?
Mm-hmm. This is the second generation after Joshua had died.
Okay.
So they in this generation did not grow up knowing who God was.
Okay.
And that could be the fault of the generation before.
There was a chapter about generations. It'll go so many generations before you'll forget me.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the exact number.
That would have been back earlier on.
Right.
Well, are you talking about the chapter in just right out after the Ten Commandments where it said visit iniquity of the fathers on the third and fourth generation? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Or, yeah. So that one would be typically, or what it's been, I don't have any proof for this, but they say that oftentimes people will do things that my dad did.
Yes.
And I might do things that my grandfather did and my great-grandfather. In other words, the third and fourth generation. However, there is a clause in there that God puts in there, and he says, "I will give mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments." So in other words, my grandfather, my father, and my great-grandfather all might have done something wrong in the eyes of God. It gets passed on to me. I come to know Jesus, the deliverer,
mm-hmm.
and he frees me from that. So now that may not get passed on to my children because God's extended. And so there's a thought out there that says after the third and fourth generation, well, that person may not struggle with that particular sin.
Right.
You got to be careful with that because my son may not struggle with exactly the same thing I struggle with, but the spirit of sin is still there in his life.
Oh,
sin
yeah.
passed on through the father. So it may not be the same characteristic or the same type of sin,
mm-hmm.
but he's still going to sin. Doesn't mean that just because I've got received forgiveness means that they...
So all Satan has to do is sit back and wait.
Yep.
Basically.
Yep. So that's what he's doing. So he's sitting there and he's using all these things around him. But God's anger burns him. Let's see what happens. Someone read 16 through 19.
"Then the Lord raised up judges to rescue the Israelites from their attackers. Yet Israel did not listen to the judges, but prostituted themselves by worshiping other gods. How quickly they turned away from the path of their ancestors who had walked in
reminds me of, this reminds me of myself as a kid. Mom and Dad are home. I obedient. I obey. I obey. I do things, everything they say. As soon as Mom and Dad leave,
it's home.
It's party time.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about anything. I can do whatever I want. They're never going to find out, so let's have at it.
And then hurry up and get it done right before they get in.
Yep, exactly. Clean everything up and sit down in a chair like you had nothing wrong, right?
All right.
Here are the children of Israel. God raises up a judge to deliver them from the raiders, from those who were taking over their possessions, right? So the judge comes along, lives 30, 40 years, everything's going great, there's peace in the land, there's no issues, there's no problems, everybody's worshiping the Lord, or following him, doing all the sacrifices and everything, and all of a sudden the judge dies. It seems like immediately as he dies, the description is that they become corrupt again. They go back to worshiping other things. God comes along again, raises up another judge. And if you read through the book of Judges, you'll have Deborah, who was a judge. She was a lady judge. You have Samson. You have Samson listed here in the Bible.
So they were like literal judges, like we have on the bench?
Similar to that, but probably they would bring their problems to them, and they would judge and rule over them and give them advice and counsel, and they would get the word from the Lord. God would speak to them, Samuel, and so on and so forth. And so God's raised them up, and there's all these judges, and it brings free, brings a pretty cool thing here. Othithnel and Ehud, those are two right off the bat. Shamgar, he killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. That's how many at one time by himself. So he was one man against 600, and he killed him with an ox goat. Imagine that type of man of valor. Then you have Deborah. You can keep reading on reading through. We have the song of Gideon comes through there. He defeats the Midianites with 300 men, soldiers. You have all that, and it becomes Abimelech rules. And then you have Jotham's parable, Shechem. You have all these different judges in there. Tola becomes a judge. It tells of Japheth, on and on, goes all the way through the book of Judges. Samson is one of the well-known ones in there, but there's a lot of other ones in there. Elion, Abaddon, Ibazah, Ephraim, Jethro's, Japheth's vow, he's a judge, and he makes a vow with God, God, you give me freedom, free us from the dominion of the Amorites, and I will offer on a sacrifice to you whichever comes out of my door first. And his daughter came out to meet him. And so then you can kind of see those are the stories all the way through Judges. I would encourage you, if you have time, to read through some of them. Powerful, powerful stories of what God did with the children of Israel and freeing them with the judges. But every time afterwards, they would revert right back to not following God. They would go back to worshiping idols. They would go back to worshiping that.
And all the judges were part of the 12, right? Tribes.
Oh yeah, different tribe. They were from all different tribes, yeah. But over and over again, they were consistently. God delivers them. They fall back in it. God delivers them, and you kind of think it goes back. You would learn after again, just like their forefathers did when they came out of Egypt. Don't complain anymore. God's gonna. No, they don't learn. Just keeps right on beating itself. I think we're getting a hint here that that's how mankind really is.
Well, what did they get?
Well, that's a very good question. Let me ask you, what fascinates you when you stray away from God, son? Because you're not, if you're like me, you're not perfect, are you? So you will stray away from God, right? From time to time. I mean, you may not forget God, but you don't always do what he says, right?
No.
You take your will.
Right. I don't always do what God says, but I stray away from him. So what makes me do that? Selfishness. What else? In other words, what looks good over here that would make you... You know all the good aspects about God. You see all of God's creation. You see the sovereignty of God. You know that he is all powerful. And yet there's this thing over here that kind of dangles there and says, oh, it's okay, come on over here. And I don't know, maybe use a simple illustration. Let's say I'm watching a movie. Well, the movie's probably not the cleanest and the most wholesome movie to watch, but here's what God says over here. Don't put anything unwholesome before your eyes. Don't put anything in your heart but my word. You know, hide that word in my heart that you might sin against me. And then all of a sudden we're over here, we're sitting down one night and we're watching a movie that's probably not what God would want, right? Well, we know that God says this, just like children of Israel said, hey, if you go after and I'm going to burn against you. And then we have this.
But everybody watches that.
Well, yes, or even then you don't even know if anybody watches. A new movie comes right out, and all of a sudden you slip over and you watch, man, I want to watch it. What makes you go over and do that? You know what God says. You know what I mean? And so just using that as an example, it's very, very easy to be deceived. And Satan paints this picture, well, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, God still loves you. He won't ever chastise you. He won't discipline you. He won't punish you. You know, it's okay. You'll be okay. Now, in children of Israel's time, the deliverer hadn't come yet. So they had specific things they had to do in order to have their sins covered. Remember? The covering and having the mercy seat sprinkled with blood and all that stuff.
So the ark was still in existence?
Yes, the ark was still here. Yeah, they would carry this wherever they would go. So the ark was moving around with them. You'll see that when they crossed the Jordan River, the high priest and the priest carried the ark on their shoulder and they stepped into the water. And when they stepped into the water split, just like the Red Sea. Everybody walked through on dry land. They stayed in the center until everybody got across. And then as they crossed, and before they got out of it and the water came back, Joshua said, go back and get 12 stones. Take 12 stones, one from each tribe, bring them out of the river, put them on the other side so that it would be a memorial to remind all the generations of what God did for them. And then they came out of the river and the Jordan River came back closed. So the ark was with them as they moved around. So the presence of God would come down still and meet inside this tabernacle. Let's skip over here to 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 1 through 7. Now we're moving into where God, the children of Israel, start complaining about these judges. And they want to be like everybody else. Let's see what it says. Let someone read 1 Samuel 8, 1 through 7. Anybody got it? Don't worry about pronouncing it wrong.
As Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons to be judges over Israel. Joel and something else, his oldest sons, held court in Beersheba. But they were not like their father, for they were greedy for money. They accepted bribes and perverted justice. Finally, all the elders of Israel met and ran to discuss the matter with Samuel. Look, they told him, you are now old and your sons are not like you. Give us a king to judge us like all the other nations have. Samuel was displeased with their request and went to the Lord for guidance. Do everything they say to you, the Lord replied, for it is me they are rejecting, not you. They don't want me to be their king any longer.
Okay, so we have this. Samuel is the last judge. He's getting old, and he begins to appoint his sons. And the children of Israel recognize that Samuel's sons are not like Samuel. They recognize that Samuel is, they're not like Samuel. Maybe they're honesty, maybe they're dishonest. As you read through here, you'll begin to see how wicked his Samuel's sons really were. And the children of Israel saw this. And so they began to look around them and they saw all the nations around. We don't need no judges anymore. We just need a king. So give us a king, Samuel. Samuel gets angry about that because that's not what God had set up. God had set judges up. Right? And then God tells him, well, don't worry about that. And why did God say that they were rejecting him and not Samuel. Because it said,
they're going against what God had said.
Right. God set the judges up, right?
Yes.
And God wanted the children to follow him. Not a king. He wanted them to follow him. And so when God sets up the rulers, he takes down the rulers. Right? And that's what he wanted the children of Israel. By basically what they were telling God is that we don't want you anymore. We want to be like all the other nations around us. And I think sometimes we do that.
So at this point, was God still speaking directly, or would this have been?
He would have been speaking through the judges. Mm-hmm. The judge. So Samuel would have been the messenger for, and that, all the judges would have been messengers that God would have spoke to. When you get a little later on, we'll have what's called the prophets. We get into where they're prophets. So you had the judges, you had the prophets. God began to speak through them.
So today, God was speaking just to them, but not to the people.
Directly to the people, right.
Now, but is this the same as, this is separate from like the garden? He doesn't talk like the same way? Or was he still speaking?
Like in a physical form? Or?
No, just in like as you could hear his voice.
Oh, you mean if Samuel's hearing his voice? Oh, I believe so, because as a boy, in the story of Samuel, his mother wanted to have a son, couldn't have a child. She begged and pleaded with God, said, I'll give you my son if you give me a son. So God blessed her with a son, and she gave Samuel over to the priesthood, who then he became a judge in Israel, and he worked under the high priest in the tabernacle, ministering, doing the chores and things of the tabernacle. And one day when he was sleeping, you know the story, right? God calls out to Samuel and says, Samuel. Samuel wakes up, runs to Eleazar the priest and says, what do you want, sir? I didn't call you. Go back to bed. Goes back to bed. Samuel. And he does this over and over again until finally Eleazar realizes, said, well, wait a minute. That's God calling. Go back, and the next time he says, Samuel, say, speak, Lord, for your servant hears. And so Samuel does that, and from there on you have this relationship with Samuel and God, God speaking to Samuel. So we know that it's an audible voice. How, and was it like we're talking here? Was it a big booming voice that everybody heard? No, it would have been a word given to him. And at times, I don't know that it was actual verbal. Sometimes a word can come from the Lord that's not directly. It could come through the scriptures that they would have had, the law. God would have been giving them that and things like that too. So, but I also believe that God spoke directly to them because we have stories in the Bible that tell us this took place. And so it's a piece of history. So let's see what happens here though. So they get angry, and down to verses 14 through 15 it says this. Well, Samuel begins to warn. So he goes and he gives a warning to the children of Israel through this whole thing. And he's in this middle of his warning here. And he says, he will take away the best of your fields. And in other words, if you get a king, I'm going to give you a king. God says he'll grant you your request of a king, but I want you to know what you're going to get. And I want you to think about the United States and the President of the United States and all of the Congress and senators. And the President is like our king. Okay? The king will take your daughters from you and force them to cook and bake and make perfumes for him. He will take away the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his own officials. He will take a tenth of your grain and your grape harvest and distribute among his officers and attendants. He will take your male and female slaves and demand the finest of your cattle and donkeys for his use. What's he telling them?
Basically, they're going to be like in bondage again, or to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so by giving up all their possessions or portions of their possessions,
mm-hmm.
That they were going to be ruled over, I guess.
Now, do you think that changed their mind? Wait a minute. Now, let me tell you something. Wait a minute. Hold on a second. If Trump stood up there and he said, I am going to come to your house, Scott, mm-hmm. when I become president, and I'm going to take a tenth of everything you own. Everything you grow in your garden, I get a tenth of for my food. How about a tenth of all your chicken check that you get? I'm going to take a tenth of that. I got to take a tenth of all the chickens you grow, Josh, for my soldiers. You going to want him in as president, as king?
Call it a tax.
That's what they do. They call it a tax. Do you see what I mean? Do you real quickly begin to say, wait a minute, I don't want anybody taking my chickens. I don't want anybody taking part of my money.
Right.
They didn't stop there. No, they said, no, Samuel, go find us a king. And here's what happens. So we get this king, and his name is Saul. Then Samuel said to the people, come, let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom. So they all went to Gilgal, and in a solemn ceremony before the Lord, they made Saul king. Then they offered peace offerings to the Lord, and Saul and all the Israelites were filled with joy. They made this man Saul king. Now Saul was the least of his family. He was tall. He was a handsome man. He was of the tribe of Benjamin, the least tribe, the youngest tribe. And so here he is, and he becomes their king. And you can skip over to Samuel 13 through 14, and it says this: how foolish, Samuel said, you have not kept the command of the Lord your God. Had you kept it, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom must end, for the Lord has sought out a man of his own heart. The Lord had already appointed him to be leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command. And basically here in this story, what happens is you have a king who God told him, go into the land and I want you to wipe out the entire nation of Amorites. And when they went out to fight, they were supposed to kill all the cattle, all the animals. Everything was to be wiped out. Not a single living soul or animal was to be left alive. So Samuel goes to meet him up, and he doesn't wait for Samuel to come, and he offers a sacrifice to the Lord without waiting for Samuel. And when he gets there, he says, why did you do this? Well, you didn't show up at the time appointed, so I took it upon myself and offered a sacrifice to God and praise for it. And then Samuel says, what do I hear in the background? Well, I hear all this bleating of sheep and gnawing of goats and cows mooing and whatever else. And he says, oh, well, the soldiers kept those. I kept the word of the Lord. The soldiers kept those. The only person I saved alive was the king. The king here. And Samuel says, bring me a sword. And he cuts the king's head off, kills him in front of everybody. And he says, because you disobeyed God, the kingdom is no longer yours. And that's what he is saying here. You are no longer, God has given your kingdom over to another. Does God's character change? No. When God says he's wanting something done, we do it his way or the highway. In essence, or we lose everything. Mm-hmm. That's what he says. Do that. And I'm not going to read all these other verses here because it's the story of David and how David is selected. But we're going to skip over to 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 1 through 3. You can read this. Read chapter 16 through Samuel, first chapter 5, verse 4. You will start to see that David and then God gives David the kingdom. You know, King David is called as a man after God's own heart. In the Bible, and we'll see some of that here. But 2 Samuel 5, 1 through 4 says this. And the tribes of Israel went to David at Hebron and told him, we are your own flesh and blood. In the past, when Saul was our king, you were the only one who led the forces of Israel. And the Lord told you, you will be the shepherd of my people Israel. You will be Israel's leader. So there at Hebron, King David made a covenant before the Lord and all the elders of Israel, and they anointed him king of Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years in all. He had reigned over Judah from Hebron for 7 years and 6 months, and from Jerusalem he reigned over all Israel and Judah for 33 years. So he died. We know that David's going to die when he's 70 based off of this. We're not to the point where David dies yet, but in this passage, but because he was 30 years old and he reigned for 40 years.
Right.
So, yeah, so about 70 years old when David was going to die. So you have this picture here, David becoming king. And you, as you go a little bit further on, you, if you read those next chapters there, they move the ark to the city of Jerusalem. They begin to move the ark there, and there's a story of what happens when they move it improperly, not obeying God's law. Someone reaches out to touch it, and it gets, man dies. And finally, they bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. And here we are in chapter 7, verses 1 through 3. And it says this, "When King David was settled in his palace, and the Lord had given him rest from all the surrounding enemies, the king summoned Nathan the prophet. And looked, David said, I am living in a beautiful cedar palace, but the Ark of God is out in a tent. Nathan replied to the king, go ahead and do whatever you have in mind, for the Lord is with you. David was beginning to say, hey, look at this. I live in a grand, massive palace, and yet God, where God's presence comes down, is in a tent. In other words, a tabernacle.
Mm-hmm.
But the tabernacle is what God had set up, right?
Initially.
Right. That's what he wanted to be in. So here's David wanting to bring God into something that God really did intend for his people to be a part of. See, God wanted to be able to lead his people, right? And he wanted his people to follow him. Wherever he went, God says, okay, I go over here, you go over here. It's kind of like us today. That's what God wants us to do. He wants us to follow him wherever he leads us in life. And sometimes we say, no, we want to have this. And we tell God, and God says, well, all right, we'll have your way then. And that's what he told him. A little later on, you can read there, and it says, but the same night the Lord said to Nathan, go tell my servant David, this is what the Lord declares. Are you the one that built a house for me to live in? I have never lived in a house from the day I brought you out of Egypt into this very day. I was always moved from one place to another with a tent and a tabernacle as my dwelling. I've always gone with the Israelites wherever you go. So he's telling them this in a dream. This is not what I envisioned. This is not what I wanted. But let's see what God does, though. Skip on down to verse 12 and through 17, and he says this, for when you die and are buried with your descendants, I will raise up one of your descendants, your own offspring, and I will make his kingdom strong. He is the one who will build a house, a temple for my name, and I will secure his royal throne forever. I will be his father, and he will be my sons. If he sins, I will correct and discipline him with the rod, like any father would do. But my favor will not be taken from him as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from your sight. Your house and your kingdom will continue before me for all time, and your throne will be secure forever. So Nathan went back to David and told him everything the Lord had said in his vision. I skipped a lot there where he was talking about the tabernacle. And he gives him this picture. So God promises that David's son will build the temple. He's going to build the house, a temple for my name. And the reason he would not let David do that is because David was a man of war. And that picture that David was a man of war, he was a picture that he loved going to war. He was in battle. He always went to battle. David was known as a great man of valor, a soldier. And so God says, no, that's not. What does that tell you about God? Does God enjoy war? No, he doesn't. God doesn't enjoy war. He doesn't enjoy war any more than anybody else would. But before he was God, he was going to let Solomon, his son, build the tabernacle.
So God was letting him, like they say, plant his people there instead of moving.
Yeah. That wasn't his wish. That's not what he wanted. He said, I've never lived in a temple. I've always lived in a tabernacle that you could move around.
He never once complained. It says, I never once complained, unlike the Israelites.
Oh, God. Said,
yeah. I'm saying, yeah. I moved around a lot.
Yeah, he even says, I've never asked them, why haven't you built me a cedar house or built a massive house for me? It kind of catches the character of God. Even though God is in heaven now, preparing a place, a mansion for us, as the Bible says, that I go there to prepare a place for you. Mm-hmm. And I often wonder, is it really going to be a, it says mansion, but what is a mansion in God's eyes?
Yeah.
You know, we think of a mansion like these big cathedrals and big houses full of gold and silver and, you know, here on this earth. But I oftentimes wonder, well, God considered a tabernacle just a fine place to be. I don't know. I'm hoping my mansion's pretty big. Well, flip over to 1 Chronicles 22. We skip quite a few pieces of history here. 5-6. David said, "My son Solomon is still young and inexperienced, and since the temple is to be built for the Lord must be magnificent structure, famous and glorious throughout the world, I will begin making preparations for it now." So David collected vast amounts of building materials before his death. Then David sent for his son Solomon and instructed him to build the temple for the Lord, the God of Israel. Get this picture. Here's Dad. I'm picturing my father. So, my dad, when we used to do chickens, would say, "Okay, you guys go in and set up the chicken house, and here is your list. You do this, 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 and this, and this, and everything gets done. But you got to do it in this order. Do this, do this." My dad was an organizer, so he loved to have everything laid out step by step. I get a lot of that for myself, I guess. I got a lot of my wife smiling over here. This, this, and this, this, and this. You have all these steps, and you get it done. You don't miss anything, right? So get this. This is what they... Huh?
I said OCD.
OCD? We call him perfectionist. That's what we called my dad. You were perfectionist, Dad. But you can get this picture of David doing the same thing for his son. He's got all these grand plans of what the temple's going to look like, and he's laying out all this stuff, and he gets everything laid out. Now, in my rebellious stage with my dad, I would always argue with him. "Dad, you don't need to do this step, and this step.
We can bypass all that."
Exactly. That's what we can skip all those steps and get it done just as fast without doing all those steps.
Right.
And it'll be done right. "No, son, I'm not doing that." And then when my dad wasn't around, we didn't do those steps. We cut them out. Solomon here is having to follow his dad's instructions. We heard from Lynn on Sunday that the temple was white marble and gold-plated. Mm-hmm. And this is what, you know, the temple would have been like. Now, this temple would have been destroyed. David's temple would have been destroyed and rebuilt again later on. And one of the conquests of Nebuchadnezzar now. And we have the story of that found in Nehemiah, one of the prophets. But that's what you get this. So he's building this thing, gets everything laid out. Skip all the way to Chronicles 29, 26 through 28. And we have this description. From the clan of Amram, Shebuel was a descendant of Gershom, son of Moses. He was the chief officer of the treasuries, his relative through Eleazar. I'm not even going to pronounce all those names. Shemimoth and his relatives were in charge of the treasuries containing the gifts that King David and the family leaders, the generals and captains, and others officers in the army had dedicated to the Lord. These men dedicated some of the plunder they had gained in battle to maintain the house of the Lord. Shemimoth and his relatives also cared for the gifts dedicated to the Lord by Samuel, the seer, Saul's son, Kish, Abner, son of Ner, Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and all other dedicated gifts were in their care too. These guys were in charge of this vast treasury that was given to the Lord to have that. I'm going to quickly. This is a picture of what projected possibly what the tabernacle or the temple would have looked like. So here we are in Jerusalem. This is where it's at. And I'm seeing this blown up picture where this would have been. Israel's to the north, Judah's to the south. They are all part of the 12 tribes. And we get to, boy, I'm way behind. That's amazing, I'm way behind. Wow. There you go. White marble. Doesn't show the gold plating on this one here. The gold pillars on the inside, the door to the front. And so here they are. In 2 Chronicles 2, 1, it gives you a picture here if you were to read and look at everything here that was going on. So Solomon decided to build the temple to honor the name of the Lord, and also a royal palace for himself. So he's got two projects going on at one time. He's got his own palace going on, he's got God's house going on. He enlisted a force of 70,000 laborers, 80,000 men to quarry the stone in the hill country, and 3,600 foremen. So he had 3,600 managers of this project. Solomon also sent the message to the king Hiram of Tyre, "Send me cedar logs as you did for my father when he was building his palace. I'm building a temple to honor the name of the Lord my God, and it will be a place set apart to burn fragrant incense for him, to display the special sacrificial bread and the sacrificial burnt offerings," and on and on and on with all the things. It's going to be a magnificent temple. And he also tells him, "Send me master craftsmen who can work with gold, silver, and bronze. It's purple, scarlet, and blue cloth. He must be a skilled engraver who can work with the craftsmen of Judah and Jerusalem, who are selected by my father David." And he gets all these cedar things. "I will send you 100,000 bushels of crushed wheat for these cedars, and for the payment for the woodcutters and all these. 100,000 bushels of barley, 110,000 gallons of wine, 110,000 gallons of olive oil." This is what he's going to use to pay for all this stuff. This is not a small project. This is like building one of the skyscrapers in New York City. We're talking a huge endeavor to build this thing and his palace. So he goes on and he skips over here to chapter 5, verses 1. "And so Solomon finished all his work on the temple of the Lord, and he brought all the gifts of his father David and dedicated the silver and gold and various articles, and he stored them in the treasuries of the temple of God."
How long did David reign over Israel?
40 years. The number 40 comes back up again, don't it? Yep. So we have all that, and he's got this tabernacle. And there was a lot of things that were in there. In the tabernacle, they had the curtain that they used in the tabernacle was also in the temple, separating a place where God could come.
So they kept that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they kept that. They remember again, that curtain symbolizes separating God, the holiness of God, from man's sinfulness.
Yes.
And that was the purpose. And that was kept in there. And so they dedicate the temple. 7 verses 1 through 4. Let's see what happens. "So when Solomon finished praying, fire flashed down from heaven and burned up the burnt offerings and sacrifices, and the glorious presence of the Lord filled the temple. The priests could not enter the temple of the Lord because the glorious presence of the Lord filled it. When all the people of Israel saw the fire coming down and the glorious presence of the Lord filling the temple, they fell on their face, down on the ground, worshipped and praised the Lord, saying, 'He is good. He is faithful. His faithful love endures forever.' Then the king and all the people offered sacrifices to the Lord. King Solomon offered a sacrifice of 22,000 cattle and 120,000 sheep and goats." That's a lot.
That's a lot.
To worship God. That's what they did. When we think of the sacrifices, this was out of praise and adoration. These were not the sacrifices they were commanded to offer yet yearly. We had the Day of Atonement that they were supposed to offer sacrifices for sin, right? The high priest would go in, sprinkle the blood on the mercy seat. He could only go in there once a year. If the high priest did everything exactly right, what would God do? In other words, if the high priest did everything right on the Day of Atonement, what would God do? He would forgive their sins of the Israelites, and it would be a covering for them. That was what the atonement would be. Were the animals actually paying for the price? The blood of the animals? No, that was not paying for the price. God had promised to send them to deliver, and he was going to do that. After Solomon dies, we get this, Solomon's going to die. And when Solomon dies, we're not going to read about that, but when Solomon dies, there's going to be lots of kings after him that are going to rule Israel. And not all those kings are going to be good kings. They're not going to be great kings. As a matter of fact, Solomon, even as he got older in life, he fell away from God.
Right.
He married, he had 700 wives and 300 concubines, so he had 1,000 women.
He went off the deep end at the end.
I think he did. And what made him go off the deep end? Anybody remember?
Mm-hmm.
Anybody? He worshipped gods of his wives.
That's what it was.
His wives that he married were not all followers of God. Not followers of the great I Am, and he began to worship them.
Why did he worship them?
Why did he worship them? Well, let's see. Does John do everything you ask him to do? He doesn't. Well, that's great, John. That's awesome.
No.
No, Scott, do you do everything that you do? No, you don't?
No.
Oh, man. Josh, do you do everything that Sarah asked you to do?
Oh, yeah.
Do I do everything that you asked me to do?
No.
Okay, some of you wives are supposed to say yes. I mean, yeah. In other words, it's a little...
I don't know what's your thing that he asked me to do either.
Ah, okay.
So it didn't take.
Can you imagine, though? He has 700 wives and 300 concubines.
Right.
Okay, so he has 700 wives coming to him and saying, hey, would you come with me and worship my God today?
Yes.
No, I can't do that because I worship the only true God.
Next day, would you come with me and worship my God with me? If you had that happening 700 times... Every time, you're going to get tired of it, and or you can say, "Well, they're not being punished by God, so it must not be anything to just worshiping God." Well, let me go over here, and Solomon began to forget what God had done for him.
What was the there was a promise God made to David about his son?
Yes. And what did he say? Do you remember the promise? Says that if you will obey me and follow me, your generation after generation will continue to be the your lineage will stay on, right?
So you didn't actually promise that he would stay with Solomon, his son. That probably would be a promise.
He said your family will reign forever. In other words, in the lineage. And if you look at that today, the line of the deliverer comes through David. So you have that promise fulfilled, in essence, because of the deliverer coming, the deliverer living forever. But they had to obey. He didn't do that with Saul, because Saul disobeyed. Now you think about that and say, well, David had someone killed, so he's a murderer. He commits adultery. You have all those things where David did, and how can God consider him a man after his own heart? When Saul just disobeyed and offered a sacrifice and didn't kill all the animals. It's the same thing as Moses. Disobeyed, God followed through and said, you're going to... David's punishment, he was not allowed to build the temple. Because he was a man of war, because he disobeyed God. He was not able to build the temple. But he said, I'll let your son build it. But you will not, you yourself will not. God's still character still comes through. There's consequences to David's actions.
But didn't God choose Saul because he knew this was somebody that would be attractive for the people? In other words, he was such a wonderful looking person that he knew that they would all be like, yeah, that's a perfect choice. But when he picked David, he didn't look at David's...
that is correct.
His, what kind of person he was.
He was a small man.
Mm-hmm. He looked at what his heart was and saw that his heart was... he wanted to do the right, and he wanted to follow God. And so I think he gave them... It's almost like the
would God pick and choose two different types of kings there? I was going to add, I was going to challenge you on that, Joel, that I don't know that God chose Saul. I think the children of Israel cast lots.
Yes. Wow.
And Saul was selected out of the lot. And then everybody said, here's a man who's
worthy to be king.
Well, God does control the lot. You're correct, yeah. Anybody here familiar with what the lot would kind of be like? I'd be like kind of me today taking and saying, okay, give me three names, John, Scott, and Josh. I'm going to put them in. I'm going to take two of those names, and we push them around in a bowl and stick them in a book and put three books up on the table and say, okay, now one of you guys go up and pick out of out of that. And so the lots were cast, and nobody knew. It's not like an election like today where we vote.
That's what I thought. Maybe it was something.
This was a lot cast. Yeah, they did this over and over again until, and when you, if you go back and read the story of where Ammon stole from this battle after Jericho, and he hid his stuff under a tent. That's how they found out about him. They cast lots among them, and the lot fell on his family's name, and then they cast lots on his name, and it fell on his family, and then he came and asked him, do you have anything that you hid? And he said, yeah, I hid 30 pieces of garments under my tent and so many pieces of silver, and said, okay, bring it, and he brought it. And then they said, well, because you disobeyed God and because you cost, I forget how many, but thousands of men died in the next battle because of that, they stoned his whole family, and women, children, and him. And God then blessed them for the next battle because they had taken that. And so you have that. When you have God in control of something, yes, there is God was in control, so God did ultimately select, even with the lot, Saul. And it would have been, his heart would not have been right. In the next lesson, we're going to be into, in lesson 28, we're going to be talking about his prophets, God's prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, all these prophets we're going to be going through. And just wanted you to see this thing here. During this time, in Judah, in the line of the kings, specifically in Judah, there were 20-some kings that ruled after the children of Israel said, we want a king. Where 20-some kings ruled there, some righteous, some unrighteous. And in Israel, up here, there were 20 kings that ruled before the deliverer came. So you have kings during this time that, while there were when the prophets come. So you have the kings now that we've talked about. There's 20. What's 20 make?
40.
Told you that number 40 is going to keep popping up over and over again in the Bible as you see
right.
It. And you'll begin to see that. Everything you learned today, what are some similarities in our society that tie into these different phases of lessons that we talked about?